Second Chronicles chapter 32. Second Chronicles chapter 32. The title of this morning's message is Preparing for War. Preparing for War. If you haven't noticed, it seems that we are right on the edge of war. If you know somebody in the reserves, you've probably heard them getting called up. Some people are already being sent out into active duty. Those who are on active duty are being trained left and right, up and down, all over the place. A few of us have loved ones that are already over in the Persian Gulf. You know, as you hear all the reports and all the things going on, we are on the edge of war. In a way, there's nothing new about this. There's nothing new. As long as there have been nations, there have been wars. My hope, we're going to look at some things that a king named Hezekiah is going to do in getting ready for his war. And this morning is not about, it's really not about politics. My aim was not to pump up the war in Iraq. No. But see, my goal this morning is to try to plant some thoughts in your head so that as you hear all the increasing things going on, you might think about another war that we're in that's already going on. And like it or not, you're in a war. What I want to challenge you to think about is whether you're prepared or not for the war. We are in a war. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 10:3, he says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." We are in the middle of an invisible war. We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, spiritual wickedness in high places. We are in a war, preparing for war. I want to talk about that. Chapter 32, verse 1. "After these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities and thought to win them for himself. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city. And they did help him. And there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? Also, he strengthened himself and built up all the wall that was broken and raised it up to the towers and another wall without and repaired Millo in the city of David and made darts or weapons or javelins and shields in abundance. And he set captains of war over the people and gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city and spake comfortably to them, saying, Be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. For there be more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah." This is that battle that we talk about every once in a while. This is that big one. This is the one where God's going to do an incredible, amazing thing. And Hezekiah will pray, and the next night, 185,000 Assyrians are killed by a single angel. This is that battle. This is that huge thing. It's written about in Kings. It's written about in the book of Isaiah. And we'll see this again. We'll see this on Wednesday night. But I want to talk about what he did to get ready for the battle, preparing for the battle. It says in verse 1, it says, "After these things, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came." after what things? If you look at the previous couple chapters, Hezekiah has been busy. This is actually takes place in the 14th year of his reign. He isn't a brand new king. He's kind of been going for a while. At 14th year, that put him about 39 years old. He started when he was 25 years old. Hezekiah was one of the good kings. He was one of the best of the best. He was one who loved the Lord with all of his heart. He was the guy that when he took over, he cleaned house in the temple. The temple had been all boarded up and put out of business, and he opened the place for business, had the place repaired, got the priests back to work, brought the people back to God. We saw last week how he sent messengers through the whole nation, not just the southern kingdom, but he even went out of his own borders and went to the northern kingdom of Israel and brought all these people to worship God. It's that guy, Hezekiah. He's a guy that loves God. At the last two verses of the previous chapter, in chapter 31, verse 20, it says, "And thus did Hezekiah throughout all Judah, and he wrought that which was good and right and truth before the Lord his God. And in every work that he began in the service of the house of God and in the law and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered." This is a great guy. He loves God. And he does what's right. And after these things, Sennacherib comes. Hard times will come. Even to the good guys. Hard times will come. Even to the good guys. Or you could say bad things happen to good people. We sometimes have this notion ingrained into our brain that says, when something bad happens, wow, what, you know, have you ever had this where something bad happens to your life and you say to yourself, what have I done to deserve this? Has anybody ever, have you ever asked yourself this? Yeah, we've all asked this, haven't we? Sometimes the bad stuff happens to a friend. And the temptation is to be like Job's friends, where we say, what did you do? What did you do, buddy? How come you're having all this trouble? I don't know, maybe it's like when we trained our dogs or something. You know, the dog is bad, you spank the dog. You know, the dog is good, you reward the dog. You make something like that. Or you do that with your kids, you know, you do that. You know, you're bad child, bad, you know, no more TV for tonight, you know. I don't know where we get this idea. But the truth is, bad stuff happens. Why did the Columbia disaster happen yesterday? Is it God's judgment on us? I know there will be. I heard this morning that there are people saying that. Maybe that's possible, but not necessarily so. Were these shuttle astronauts, did they do something really bad while they were up in space? I doubt it. In fact, I read how they, you know, the Israeli astronaut observed Shabbat in space. You know, he read that they had on the 28th a memorial service for some of the past astronauts who have died, you know, the Apollo thing on the launch pad, and then the Challenger disaster. Interesting. The commander was a Christian. Michael Husband, Mr. Husband, Commander Husband, was a Christian. Sang in his church's choir, loved the Lord. Bad things happen, even to good people. Um, Sometimes bad things happen because God's trying to wake us up. Sometimes I've done some stuff and God's trying to wake me up. But sometimes I haven't done anything. 1 Peter 4:12 says, Peter says, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you." Look at Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. Matthew 7, verse 24. I was teasing Dave Rittner first service that I was stealing another one of his verses from the Sermon on the Mount, and he assured me that the rate he's going, he's not even going to get close to Matthew chapter 7. So he's doing the Sunday night Bible study. Matthew 7, verse 24, Jesus tells a parable, and he says, Matthew 7, 24, "Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it." Now, there are two people that Jesus contrasts in this story. Both are people who have heard his word. Now, it's great because he's just given the one of the best sermons anybody's ever given in the whole wide world, Sermon on the Mount. And he's just given this teaching. And so he's talking to people who've just heard him speak. And so he's not talking to people. He's not talking about people who've never heard him speak. He's talking to people like you and I. Okay, that's one thing. Both people have that in common. There's something else that both people have in common. Both people go through the storm. Both people, the storm is going to hit. Sennacherib is going to come. And the question is not, what have you done to deserve it? The question is, are you going to survive it? That's the question. When we talk about getting ready for war, and we talk about what Hezekiah is going to do here, the question isn't, how do I keep the enemy away? No, the question is, how are you going to survive? Hard times will come. Storms will come. Let's go back to Chronicles. And so when Hezekiah saw, verse 2, when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come and that he purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men. He saw that Sennacherib was to come. And it says he saw that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem. The Hebrew phrase is literally, he had his face towards Jerusalem. The guy was determined. He's marching to Jerusalem. History tells us that that during this campaign, Sennacherib would wipe out something like 46 cities and towns in the kingdom of Judah. I mean, the guy is leveling everything in his path. The first thing that he actually does is recorded in 2 Kings 18. When he first hears that Sennacherib is coming, he gathers up all the money he can. And it says he gathered up, in 2 Kings 18, it says he gathered up 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. He even went as far as cutting the gold off of the doors of the temple. And he gave everything he could to the Assyrians to try to send them away. But the Assyrians are kind of like bullies. It's like there's no negotiating peace with them. You can talk as much as you want, but they're still coming. It says, verse 3, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city. Took counsel with his princes and his mighty men. Now you're going to think I'm studying too much for one, this next bit. Mighty men. The Hebrew word is gibor. Maybe it's giborim because it's plural. His mighty men. When you think of mighty men, what do you think of? Who do you think of? Schwarzenegger. Oh, think Bible. Bible. Shirley, you're wonderful. I think of King David. David and his mighty men. I'm sorry. It's just, I'm not, okay. I am not even on the same page as you, so why am I wasting your time? Okay. I think of David as mighty men. And so I was reading that, and I was kind of going, David, my mighty men. Hey, you know, I'm not sure I've read about too much mighty men since we've been studying, since we were back in David. And that's been hundreds of years. I went through and I looked at all the times where you see this gibor and you see mighty men and stuff. And there's something like 68 times in the Old Testament that gibor is used. And you know, the majority of it is with King David and his mighty men. Other guys had mighty men. Jehoshaphat had mighty men. He was a pretty good king. Amaziah had mighty men. He was pretty good. Of all the 68 references, I only found like two that were bad people. And I kind of came to the conclusion. This is off track. Sorry, this is just for you trivia people. Good kings surround themselves with mighty men. I don't see any mighty men around the wimpy kings. You know, the wimpy kings. Good kings, strong kings, don't have a problem surrounding themselves with mighty men. And here's Hezekiah. I'm sorry, this is just a little sidetrack. Okay, back on path. Here we go. Verse 3. You're just all looking at me like, where is this guy? Okay. He took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the foundations which were without the city, and they did help him. So they gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains in the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? Now, what's happening here? There's outside of the city gates, there's a place called the Spring of Gihon, Gihon Spring. And somewhere around the time of King David, somebody came up with the idea of digging a channel, an outside channel of water that would, kind of an aqueduct, that would go from the Spring of Gihon into the Pool of Siloam in the city. There was this outside, archaeologists found there was an outside aqueduct. Well, what they get to thinking of was, well, let's dig a tunnel. And so they dug a tunnel 1,777 feet. This is the days before dynamite, before bulldozers, before lasers and GPS and all this kind of stuff. 1,777 feet they dig. They have two teams, one starting at the Pool of Siloam, one starting at the Spring of Gihon, and they dig, and they're within inches. It is so accurate. And they even got the slope right, so the water flows the right way. It goes, the water flows from Gihon into the city, and they cover everything else up. They remove all the fire hydrants. They remove all the drinking fountains outside of the city because, hey, you're going to have a couple hundred thousand guys in your army. They get thirsty at night, right? And so you get rid of all the soda machines and all the drinking fountains, and it's not good for an army, is it? Are you with me? You're with me. Okay, good. I'm glad you're with me. The point is this. You want to be prepared for war? Don't strengthen the enemy. Don't strengthen the enemy. They say, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? What are we going to do? Help them out. Let's not help them out. Let's make it tougher for them. Don't strengthen the enemy. Now, we know that as Christians, we face the Saddam is going to face Army, Air Force, Marines. We face the world, the flesh, and the devil. We face a threefold force. When we talk about the flesh, this is a term we see in the Bible, and you're going to hear me using it different ways even this morning. Sometimes the word flesh refers to this stuff that you can grab a hold and pinch. you know, the arm of the flesh, you know, this is something you can get a hold of, physical stuff. But the Bible also uses, and this is what I'm talking about, uses the term flesh in a spiritual sense, and it's not anything you can get a hold of. It's an invisible part of you. We might call it our sin nature, and every one of us has got it. Every one of us has got it. It's written in the DNA. It's part of human nature, our sin nature. Every single person on this planet has it, and there's no getting rid of it. It's that part of you that wants to disobey God. Remember the cartoons? Little devil on the shoulder and an angel arguing over each other? Don't you watch TV? Hello? Okay, you with me, Lilla? Well, you know, that's not a bad picture. Promises, it's not on your shoulder. It's inside of you. There is a part of you that loves to disobey God. We call it the flesh. There is the world. That's another part of our enemy, the world. And that, too, is kind of an invisible thing. It is an organized system that's out there that wants to lead you away from God. Sometimes we think of the world in terms of Madison Avenue. You know, what's on, we think of the of Hollywood. We think of what's on TV. We think of movies. That's a part of it. It's bigger than that. It's an organized system out there that wants you loving anything but God. And then there's the devil. Demonic. Actual beings, also invisible, with intelligence, with power, directed by their head, whom we call the devil or Satan or Lucifer. He's kind of the commander-in-chief in the war against you. That's who we face. The flesh, the world, the devil. Now, my point here is don't strengthen the enemy. Don't strengthen the enemy. And of those three, the world, the flesh, and the devil, the one that I want to make you think about a little bit the most this morning is the one that's closest to you. That's the flesh. The flesh acts like a beachhead. It's where the Marines land. It's where the enemy forces attack. It's where they set up their base. And it's in you. Don't strengthen the enemy. I want to share three scriptures that I find are helpful to think about this. Look, start in Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Galatians 6, verse 7. Paul writes this, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not." Now, you know, we've got these two natures inside, the flesh and the spirit. Some people have expressed, there's an old Eskimo proverb. You probably heard Greg Laurie use this. There's an old Eskimo proverb that there are two dogs inside of you fighting. And the one that wins is the one you feed. The one that wins is the one you feed. And you and I have two natures inside of us as Christians. Now, those who have not come to trust in Jesus, they don't got two natures. They got one. Because the other one is dead. When we come to Christ, the Spirit comes alive. And once we've come to Christ, we've got two natures warring against each other. The dog you feed is the one that wins. See, don't strengthen the enemy. Cut off the water fountains. There are things that we expose ourselves to that feed the flesh. Don't strengthen the beachhead. Make it weaker. You know, I think of I like that line in The Wizard of Oz, where they take the bucket and they throw the water on the Wicked Witch of the West, and she goes, "I'm melting! I'm melting!" Well, the problem with our flesh is it never really melts. But you can sure starve the sucker. Don't feed it. Shut off the water fountains. Don't feed the flesh. There's war coming. There are tough times ahead. Second verse, Ephesians 4, verse 26. I think this is an interesting battle verse. Ephesians 4, verses 26 and 27. It says, just a few pages to the right where we were. Paul writes, "Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath." In other words, don't stay angry more than a day. Just get over it. Get over it. And then he says this, and I think it's connected. "Neither give place to the devil." The word is a foothold, or think of the beachhead. And see, one of the places that we make it easy for what do they call the landing craft? Somebody help me. Yeah, whatever. You know, you don't want the hovercrafts landing on your beach. One of the ways you clear the area for him is when you get angry. Don't give him a beachhead. Don't do it. One last verse. It's been an encouragement to me. I'm just sharing to you something personal for me. Look at John chapter 6, verse 35. John 6, verse 35. We read this a few weeks ago in our quiet times, and this was something that kind of stuck out. John 6, verse 35. Jesus said unto them, "I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst." Now, let me try to explain my thinking on this. The flesh is a thing of appetites. What the flesh is all about is about appetites. It's our appetite for stuff that's not pleasing to God. And I have desires for this bad thing and that bad thing and that bad thing. And I feed the thing. I feed the appetites. I tell myself, I've got to have that. You know, you're driving down the street, something catches your eye, and you just have to soak it up. Appetites. When I was thinking about this verse, Jesus says, "I'm the bread of life. If you eat me, you won't hunger anymore. Drink of me, you won't thirst anymore." See, I was thinking, so why do I let my appetites get out of control sometimes when Jesus should satisfy my appetite? Are you following me? I just see if you're thinking the way I was thinking. And see, one of the things that's been helpful for me the last couple of weeks is when I start, the hunger starts. I want to be satisfied with you. I don't need to hunger for anything else. Lord, take away my appetite. That's what I've been praying. And you know what? That's a cool thing. That's a cool way to pray. That's been helpful for me. Don't feed the enemy. Don't strengthen the enemy. Prepare for war. Cut off those water fountains. Make it harder for Satan, for Pete's sake. Don't open the door and set the table for him. Let's move on. back to Chronicles. So why should the kings come and find much water? Let's make it harder for them. Verse 5. And so he strengthened himself and built up all the wall that was broken and raised it up to the towers and another wall without and repaired Millo in the city of David and made darts and shields in abundance. Now, the word Millo, we think that what that might be, it's kind of in, some people aren't quite sure. We kind of think maybe it's like some terraced land underneath the walls. It helps, it's like a foundation for the walls. In other words, he's making everything safe and secure. Some of the parts of the walls around the city had kind of fallen over so that, you know, if you kind of went to sleep at night, you wake up and the enemies just kind of come, they walked through the wall because it's all, so they built up the walls. Hezekiah even built another wall. He built a second wall around it. So the enemy is going to have to face two walls to get over. He's making it harder. He is repairing what's weak. You want to prepare for war? Repair what's weak. Repair for what's weak. Repair what's weak. There is a battle coming whether you like it or not. And if you want to be ready, sometimes you have to take a little inventory of your life. Sometimes you have to kind of ask yourself, well, are there things that are weak that I need to strengthen? Do I got some walls around my city that are falling around that make it easy for the enemy to penetrate? Repair what's weak. I think that two of the walls we need around our city every day are prayer and the Word. It's pure basic. This is Christianity 101. This is stuff that you go to Mike Chapman's New Believers class, he's going to hit you on these things. You got to get the basics. You got to get the walls up around the city. We need to be secure every day in prayer and in the Word. The problem is, for some of us, you say, but Rich, I don't have time to do that three chapters a day thing. I didn't say that, did I? I didn't say three chapters a day. I said, get in the Word. If you're reading a paragraph a day, hey, it's good to have a little wall than no wall. I like the idea that Hezekiah built the wall up as high as the towers. So, I mean, he's not taking no chances. But you know what? Build up some of the wall. Every day, we need to have time in the Word. Yeah, but I'm just kind of busy. The day gets started, and I just got so much to do. You don't know my schedule. You don't know mine. Look at Luke chapter 10, verse 38. Luke chapter 10, verse 38. It says, now it came to pass as they went that he entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, which also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. And Martha was cumbered about with much. She was distracted with much serving and came to him and said, Lord, dost thou not care that my sister hath left me to serve alone? Bid her therefore that she help me. And Jesus answered and said unto her, Martha, Martha, thou art careful or worried and troubled about many things. But one thing is needful, and Mary hath chosen that good part, which shall not be taken away from her. You know what? Don't get to thinking that you're too busy to spend time with God. If you're too busy for that, then you're too busy not to spend time with God. I don't know about you, but I'm finding that when I, you know, every once in a while, in the last 2 weeks, I've had 2 days in the last 2 weeks where I didn't have my quiet time. I confess. There you go, right in front of me. I can't believe it. Oh, it's a terrible thing to say. You know what? They were horrible days. One day I just totally forgot. And I got through and it's like, wow, why was that day so tough? Or have you ever had, I know some of you know what I'm talking about. You have one of those days where you just get off, you just get too busy, and you halfway through the day you're going, why is this day so hard? Beloved, spend time with the Lord. You need to. One of the things I've been encouraged about, Hezekiah realized where he was weak. He built up the things that were weak. Nehemiah, when he came back from Babylon to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, he rode around the city and tried to figure out what needed help. How is your time with God? How is your Bible reading doing? How is your prayer time? I think a trap that some of us fall into, I fall into this trap, is I'll read, but I won't pray. I've got some brothers around me who been challenging in that. Tim Watt, I love Tim. Tim just a great, and he's got a prayer list. He prays for every day. Challenges me, boy. Challenges me. And so I got my prayer list now. I'm not trying to say that I'm really Mr. Hot Stuff. I know some people are light years ahead of me with this. But you know what? Strengthen what's weak. Take inventory. There's only one thing that's really necessary, and that we learn to sit at Jesus' feet and listen to Him. Build the walls. Get ready for war. It's coming. Back to Chronicles. And so, verse 6, he set captains of war over the people. He gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city and spake comfortably to them. He spake comfortably to these leaders, saying, be strong and courageous. He spake comfortably. He had words, the word comfortably is lebab. That's a French word for a guy named Robert. Lebab. Lebab. Hello, lebab. No. It's the Hebrew word for heart. It's your heart. He spoke with his heart. I was curious about this spake comfortably, and I did a search for, I wonder how many, because it rang a bell, and I knew where it was, I knew where the bell was ringing, but I was curious, is this all over the place? It's only found twice, at least the phrase spake comfortably in the King James. It's used twice, and both times it's used for Hezekiah. It's used in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 22. Hezekiah spake comfortably unto all the Levites and taught the good knowledge of the word. The other translations will translate this phrase, he spoke encouragingly, or he encouraged them. I love it. Hezekiah is a guy with heart. He cares about the people around him, and he's going to encourage them. That seems to be something you see in his life. He says, verse 7, he says, be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria. Be strong and courageous. Troops need encouraging. Troops need encouraging. I don't know if you've been noticing it, but that's been going on a lot lately. Our president has been working overtime to encourage the troops. I found a thing online, Peggy Noonan. She used to be a speechwriter for President Reagan. This was her response after listening to President Bush's State of the Union address last Tuesday. Now, please forgive me. I'm not trying to get political here. I'm not trying to rally Republican or anything like that. Please, I do not mean to offend anyone who is a Democrat. I'm not even going to go there. But listen to this. I agree, this rings true to me. She wrote this. I felt at the end of the speech not roused but moved, and it took me a while to figure out why. It was gratitude. This truly is a good man, and that is a rare thing. Agree with Mr. Bush's stance or disagree, there can be no doubting the depth of his seriousness and the degree to which he attempts to do what he is convinced is right, and to lead his country toward that vision of rightness. We have had many unusual men as president, and some seemed like a gift and some didn't. Mr. Bush seems uniquely resolved to be as courageous as the times require and as helpful as they allow. There is a profound authenticity to him and a fearlessness too, a steady hand on the helm in high seas, a knowledge of where we must go and why, a resolve to achieve safe harbor. More and more, this presidency is feeling like a gift. I don't know if you saw or read or heard President Bush's address to the nation yesterday after the Challenger. How many of you heard that thing? Was that incredible or what? I mean, I praise the Lord. You need to pray for that man. You need to pray for him. And what is he doing? He's encouraging the troops. He's encouraging the troops. That's part of a role of a leader. That is part of all of our responsibility, to encourage one another. Prepare for war. Encourage one another. War is coming, and I'm not just talking Iraq. Tough times come. We need to encourage one another. Hebrews 10:23 says, "Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. Let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is." In other words, go to church. And you know what? And there you are. God bless you. He says, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves, but exhorting or encouraging one another. And so much the more as you see the day approaching. We need that. We need to encourage one another. You need to have people in your life. I hope it's been my prayer that God would encourage you this morning. That God would stir you up to love and to good deeds. To follow the Lord. To build the walls around your city. To stop up the fountains. It's been my prayer that God would encourage you. But you know what? It can't just be once a week. You've got to have people in your life who will tell you, you know, let's pray to Jesus. Let's seek the Lord. Relationships. Being prepared for battle requires encouragement. Now, he says, be strong and courageous. Verse 7. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. Don't be afraid for this multitude. The Hebrew word for multitude means a murmur, roar, crowd, tumult, sound. It's not just a lot of people. It's like noise. You know, it's like a lot of noise. Don't be scared of all the noise. Life can be pretty scary at times. Have you noticed? How many of you have noticed life can be pretty scary? Yes, the rest of you are dead. Man, can life be scary? Think about the Jews holed up in Jerusalem in Hezekiah's day. And outside the walls are the Assyrian army. Let me read to you some of the Assyrian leaders' own words about their exploits. Regarding one captured leader, a guy named Ashurnasirpal. I have no idea whether I said that right. This is what he boasted about somebody he'd captured. He says, I flayed him. His skin I spread upon the wall of the city. I'm sorry, this is the R-rated part. Close your ears if you do not like violence or images, graphic images of violence. There we go. Okay. He also wrote of mutilating the bodies of live captives and stacking their corpses in piles. Shalmaneser, who was about 850 BC, boasted of his cruelties after one of his campaigns. He said, a pyramid of heads I reared in front of his city. Their youths and their maidens I burned up in the flames. Sennacherib, this guy, this is what he wrote in his own histories. He wrote of his enemies, I cut their throats like lambs. I cut off their precious lives as one cuts a string. Like the many waters of a storm, I made the contents of their gullets and entrails run down upon the wide earth. Their hands I cut off. So you think you have bad problems? I mean, think of these folks. The Assyrians are coming. And he says, be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all this smoke, all this noise. For there be more with us than with him. Now, if you were to take account of the number of fighting men inside the city of Jerusalem at the time, and compare it to the count of fighting men who were going to be surrounding the city, I'm not so sure that you could say that Hezekiah's got his numbers right. Except Hezekiah isn't counting those heads. 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6. In 2 Kings chapter 6, the prophet Elisha is beginning to get a reputation. He's this guy with this incredible thing where he hears from God. God tells him all kinds of things. And one of the things that God's been telling him lately, every time the Syrian army is going to attack, God tells him about it. And God tells him where they're going to attack and how many guys. And so he talks to the king of Israel, and he tells him all the time. He says, you know, in about a week, you got to be up at this mountain pass because the Syrians are coming, and you got to have this many. And every time the Syrians attack, boom, they're defeated, because it's like somebody's got satellite photography or something, you know, or send, how do they do this? And he gets really upset, and his people say, well, you know, you got this problem because there's this prophet. And he tells the king of Israel everything you're doing. In fact, he even tells him the stuff you whisper in your bedroom. That must be kind of pretty embarrassing. Well, it's like, wow, ooh. So the king of Syria sends an army to get the prophet. In 2 Kings 6, verse 14, it says, therefore sent he thither horses and chariots and a great host. And they came by night and compassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early and gone forth. Now this is not Elisha. This is his servant. This is the guy that goes out and gets the paper in the morning for Elisha. And so the Orange County Register sitting out there. And it was delivered at 5:30 in the morning. And he's probably, maybe he's getting some milk bottles or something. You know, he's got this stuff. He goes out in the morning just to stretch. You know, maybe he's, doing his exercises or something. And he's stretching. And he goes forth, behold, a host, an army, come past the city, both with horses and chariots. Ah! The guy runs inside, and he says, alas, my master, how shall we do? What are we going to do? And Elisha answers, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes, that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Elisha wasn't worried at all. How did the young man's eyes get opened? How did the young man's eyes get opened? Elisha prayed. Got to be men and women of prayer. Got to be men and women of the Word. I got time. Look at Matthew chapter. Oh, this isn't in my notes. It was at one point. I X'd it, but I'm sorry. We're taking it back. Matthew, 26 or 27. Where is it? There it is. Matthew 26, verse 47. While he yet spake, this is Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. While he yet spake, lo, Judas, one of the 12, came, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, the same is he, hold him fast. And forthwith he came to Jesus and said, Hail, Master! And kissed him. And Jesus said unto him, Friend, wherefore art thou come? Then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. And behold, one of them which was with Jesus, this is Peter, Mark records this, he stretched out his hand, drew his sword, struck a servant of the high priest's, and cut off his ear. That guy's name was Malchus. And Peter starts swinging his sword, and he whacks off the guy's... This is why he's a fisherman and not a swordsman, because he only got the guy's ear. And then said Jesus unto him, Put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that thus it must be? Jesus is saying to Peter, he's saying, hey, Pete, you know, buddy, if I didn't want to be taken, don't you think I mean, Elisha was, his mountain was surrounded by angels and chariots of fire and stuff like this, you know. I don't, they were playing dun 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 dun, chariots of fire. Okay. But Jesus saying, Pete, you know what, pal? All I have to do is ask. 12 legions of angels. Well, and keep in mind that in Hezekiah's day, one angel killed 185,000. So 12 legions. Whoa! There's more on our side than are against us. The problem is you don't see them. And the reason I took you here is because knowing that there's more on our side doesn't mean that we don't have trouble. It doesn't mean that every time I get into a problem, I call out the miracles, legions of angels! Dun 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 dun! Okay, now I'm surrounded with legions of angels! Right? You know what? Jesus went to the cross. That's what he was supposed to do. Because there's more for us than against us doesn't mean I'm not going to stub my toe or have pain. But I can have comfort knowing that I'm in God's hands and He will take care of me. That's the peace that passes all understanding. What am I worried about these big burly Assyrians? I mean, I know they're bad. I know they got a reputation, but my goodness. He says, in Chronicles, he says, with him is an arm of flesh. And now we're talking about human pinch it flesh. You know, the guy is just human. But with us is the Lord, Yahweh, our God, to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. They rested themselves. They leaned on. It's like you could lay down and go to sleep on this. Our king, Jesus, said in John 14:1, let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. There's war coming. Jesus said, you trust me here. He said in John 16:33, these things I have spoken unto you, that in me ye might have peace. In the world you shall have tribulation. It's war coming. But be of good cheer.